a couple of years ago when he found out we were coming to Staten Island. It was about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. He said, he says, have you learned how to say how you doing? And I said, how you doing? And he goes, no, how you doing? He says,
how you doing?
Come here without knowing how to say that.
How you doing?
So I've been practicing ever since.
Yep.
Okay,
welcome back. Carl, how are you? Good. Yeah, we're pretty refreshed. She had a nap. I want to, we're going to get...
Rocking and rolling.
Rocking into the fourth step, but I want to tell a little story first. We're famous for our little stories, you might have noticed. Here's something that I didn't want to miss. I was talking to John at the break, and I told him I'd bring this up. I said, you look back on 20 or so years of sobriety, and you say, how could that have happened to a daily drinker like myself? What caused that to happen? And it reminded me of something that I had wanted to tell if there was time. There isn't, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Hi. Did you ever hear people say at an AA meeting, today I choose not to drink? I used to say that. I didn't know what I was saying, but I would say that because I was mimicking other people. I heard other people say it, so it sounded good, so I said it. When I met Joe and started doing this stuff with him, started going to Fellowship of the Spirit, Joe and Don both, but Joe especially, used to hammer the idea that an alcoholic is someone who has lost the choice whether they drink or not, okay? And then I started thinking, well, I've been saying, you know, today I choose not to drink, and I heard people say that at meetings. What came back, I was about 7-8 years sober, and what came back to me was something that had happened the summer of my second year of sobriety. I was 2.5 years sober. And how it tied in is this page 56 and 57, when they're talking about the minister's son, right at the end of We Agnostics, says, his alcoholic problem was taken away. That very night, years ago, it disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. And here's the deal. Seemingly, he could not drink even if he would. Okay, God had restored his sanity. And what I remembered, and I'd completely forgotten this until I started talking to Joe about some stuff, about choice. When I was 2.5 years sober, I'm a construction guy, general contractor, and I'm doing a job for a lawyer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't suggest that, but I decided to do that summer. And I left the job site at lunch, and when I came back, my workers had cut a hole in this guy's roof in the wrong place. Cut it in his living room instead of his den or something like that in a flat roof. I lost my cookies. I just completely lost it. I started yelling, screaming, but something was happening to me. Something mental was happening to me. And I couldn't breathe right. I was hyperventilating. And what I know now is I was having an episode, like a psychotic episode, you know. They call it a shame attack. But what my mind was doing, you might have heard, your mind might have done this. I know other alcoholics who have experienced this. My mind was saying, you're an effing loser. You'll never be any good. You've done this for 20 years. You still don't know what you're doing. This lawyer's going to sue you. Everybody in AA is going to know you're a jerk. Blah, 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 and it's going, and I can't stop it, and I can't breathe right, and I jump in my truck, and I scream out of there, and one of my guys who was riding with me came with me for a short distance, but when he saw I was doing like 109 miles an hour, he begged me to stop the car. He jumped out and told me, please, slow down, take it easy, it's going to be okay, and I knew it wasn't going to be okay. And I was racing towards my home. I jumped the median, started racing down towards Santa Fe, going out of my mind, and my mind is going at me 1,000 miles an hour. When I experimented with psychedelic drugs in the late 60s and the early 70s, I had some episodes where I felt like I was fighting for my sanity. Like, don't think that. Don't go there. Oh, no, don't think that. You know, and you're back and forth kind of parrying with your... And that's exactly what this was like. It was like I felt like I was hanging on by a thread, fighting for my very sanity. Okay, and so I'd been in a treatment center. I'd worked in a treatment center, and so I thought, now what did they teach me? What are my little rules of what I have to do? What are my things I need to do? And the first thing I thought of was call your sponsor. Well, it was in the days before cell phones. I couldn't have found a phone booth. Plus, my sponsor was at work at 3 in the afternoon, so that wasn't an option. Go to the club, be around sober people. The club didn't open till 6, still doesn't, okay? So that wasn't an option. And I thought, read the big book. Well, hell, I couldn't have read the phone book in the shape I was in. I mean, it was just, you know, and it was getting worse and not better. And my mind started feeding me information, and this is what it told me. It said, if you don't get down to the El Toro liquor store and get 2 shots of bourbon in you immediately, I'm going to go completely insane, lose my mind, have a psychotic break with reality, and never come back the same. And I'll spend the rest of my life in Las Vegas, New Mexico, in the state mental institution. Okay? And this was the truth. This was not just a passing thought. I knew that this was true, as well as I know I'm sitting right here. And I thought, my God, it's true. I've got to get down there and stop this. Whatever's happening to me could be fatal, you know. And so I start saying a prayer, and the prayer I said was, God, please help me. God, please help me. God, please help me. What I meant was, help me to get to the liquor store, get some booze in me so I can stop this thing that's happening to me before I go permanently insane. But I didn't finish the prayer. I just kept saying, God, please help me. What happened is I went into some sort of a crazy blackout, like an emotional blackout, and I went right past the liquor store and I never drank. Okay? Now I'm putting all this back together again about me saying, today I choose not to drink. And what I got was, that day not only did I choose to drink, I thought my sanity depended on drinking. You following me with this? I mean, this is real stories from true life. Okay? Not only did I choose to drink, but thought my sanity depended on it, and I wasn't allowed for some reason to do what I thought I had to do to stay on the planet, okay? So I don't say any longer, I choose not to drink today. That is absolutely God's business, every bit of it. I hope John understands what I'm saying. I think he does. You know, I don't choose to, I don't choose not to. It's all up to God. If I keep doing the same, and the other thing we often talk about this, I don't worship the big book. I love it, but I don't worship it, you know. All it is a manual to get to that power, okay, that if I try in a flawed way to do what it says to do in here, and I never do it perfectly, I don't even do it with grace. I do it crummy, you know. I do it half-hearted. I do it badly, you know. I do it anyway. If I just try, if I'll just reach out, God reaches the rest of the way, and I'm saved. And that's been my experience with that. I just wanted to share that quickly. Hit it.
So, the decision, third step decision. Did any of you think well?
Did you think well about the decision?
Did you any of you think?
Did you think at all? Did you think poorly?
I napped. So, we're faced with a third step decision. Y'all ready? You guys want to say the prayer together? Okay. God,
I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
So,
no amen at the end.
Amen doesn't come in till the seventh step prayer. So this book tells me that after I say that this is a beginning, but it's only a beginning. But quite an effect can be made, and we can feel that effect. But it says we must launch out on a course of vigorous action. Launched out. You ever seen, you know, on TV, the rocket ship, spaceship launch? That's what we must do. We must launch out just like that rocket ship does. Launch out in a course of vigorous action, vigorous exercise, not just like a little stroll in the park, vigorously. First step of which a personal housekeeping. So when I first set out to do this fourth step, I sat with my sponsor and we read this, and we read through the fourth step, and she said, the object is that you're going to find those things which have been blocking you from God. So she's going to find the patterns, the flaws in your makeup that cause you to do the things you do. She says it's fact-finding, and you're going to face these facts so you can get rid of them, so that God can get rid of them. So I sat down one day after we did this, and I made my list out and started writing the reasons that I was upset, angry, hurt, threatened by these people, institutions, principles, which are beliefs. And I couldn't get started. I mean, I started, but I couldn't finish. And so I met with my sponsor, and she says, what's going on with you? She says, I know you did a good first step. I know you did a good second step. I know you did a good third step. She says, I just don't get, you know, why you can't move on through with this fourth step. And she says, what goes through your mind when you sit down and write? And I said, well, I start thinking about step 6 and 7. She says, well, why would you do that? And she says, and what do you think about? I said, well, what goes through my head is, if God removes my character defects, my shortcomings, I said, I don't think there's going to be anything left of me. I'm scared to death that there won't be anything left of me. Because I thought I was nothing but shortcomings, nothing but character defects. Everything about me was flawed. Everything about me was wrong. And she looked at me and she kind of giggled a little bit and she says, oh, honey, there's so many of them, he's never going to take them all at once. And with that, I was greatly relieved. And I started writing my fourth step. So I'm going to share with you a couple of resentments that I had. So I won't, not on him, well, maybe, but.
Not why don't you tell what happened when you took your inventory to your sponsor?
Okay.
That illustrates.
All right, he likes this. So I sat down with my inventory because I was going to read her my fifth step. And I started reading, and I read through the first page, and I read probably two names, and, you know, why I was angry, and the areas it had affected, sex relations, self-esteem, security, pride, fear, ambitions, pocketbook. And then I got to the next name, and I read, you know, the other two things, and I got to the next name, and then she stopped me. And she says, wait a minute. And I said, yeah. And she said, she asked me, so where's the rest of it? And I asked, what do you mean? And she says, well, she says, it's good as far as you've gone. She said, but where's the rest of it? Where were you at fault? What have you done wrong? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And she says, oh, sweetheart, you forgot to turn the page. She sent me home to turn the page and write out the rest of my inventory, which was where I had been at fault, where I was wrong. And she made me do it in red ink so it would stand out. And I did. And after that, the other inventories I've done, because I have, after that, I had a new sponsor. And my new sponsor has me do one more column. And it comes from the sex inventory. And it's the question from the from the sex inventory that says, what should I have done instead? Knowing in my fourth column what I now know about myself, what should I have done instead of what I did? And that gives me my values. The fourth column is where I went against them. And the fifth column are my values, how I feel I should live my life. So I had a resentment against an uncle. And this uncle had sexually molested me as a child. And I had a resentment against nuns But with the resentment against my uncle, the reason was he had sexually molested me as a child, and I listed the areas that it had affected. Definitely my self-esteem, my personal relationships, my sex relationships, my ambition, and my security. So when I looked, and when I wrote those three columns down, and I said the prayer that the big book asks me to say, I feel like I'm coming from here, ax me.
Don't ax me about it.
So what it tells me is I ask God to show me the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And when this person offended, I say to myself, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful? Save me from being angry. Thy will be done.
Those are two prayers.
Then I go back to the list, prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. I'm looking at you. If you were looking at the way you're looking at me, it's a complete 180. So I went to look at this. I couldn't figure out any place in this that I had been wrong. As far as I was, I just couldn't see it. So when I'm reading my inventory, doing my fifth step with my sponsor, and we got to my uncle, I said, sorry, I got nothing going on here. I don't have anywhere where I'm wrong. I don't have anywhere where I'm at fault. And she got real quiet and she said, you're right. She says, you're absolutely right. You are not at fault. You are not wrong in any of this when you were a child. She said, but I want to ask you a question. And the question she asked me was, so tell me, what does it do to you today? What does this resentment do to you today? So I thought about it for a while, and she didn't have me answer it right away. It took me 2 days to do my fifth step. So I came back the next day, and I answered her question. And I said, you know, what it does to me today is that I use it. I use it. I use it to not have to be responsible. I use it so that I can continue to be a victim. I use it so that I can draw pity from people, or I can incite anger. Any way I could use it, I use it. So I realized that there was no wrong on my part as a child. What he did was very wrong, but I had no wrong as a child. But where I was at fault was at the age of 34. I was using it. And every time I thought about it, I made it worse and worse in my head. I played it worse and worse. The movie never played the same. I made the whole thing greater and bigger and badder. So with the fourth step, it doesn't matter whether the resentment is real. What does it say? Real or
imagined?
You know, it's a resentment, irregardless. You know, real or imagined, it doesn't matter. So that was my resentment on my uncle. Then I had a resentment with nuns. I went to a Catholic girls' school, and every day we had religion class, catechism class. And I must have been in second grade, and we're getting ready for the sacrament of communion, reconciliation. And so the nun is telling us, young nun, she was probably in her mid-20s, maybe late 20s, I can't remember. When you're, 7 years old, everybody looks old to you. But so she's talking to us about sin, and she's talking to us about venial sin and mortal sin and, what the differences are. And my little hand went up, and I asked her, well, what do you do when somebody touches you, when somebody touches you down there? And what she said to me was, well, you don't let them. Now, what I heard is it's your fault if they touch you. So I had this resentment against nuns. big resentment against nuns. So when I wrote this down, and my first sponsor didn't have any experience with this, so she basically let me slide when I got to my fourth column and I couldn't find where I was at fault. However, I went to a conference and I met a friend of mine. Her name is Rusty Kelly. She was an Al-Anon. At the time, she had over 30 years in Al-Anon. And I mentioned to Rusty that I'd had that I had an amends to make, and it was to nuns, and I told her the whole story. And she really helped me with that last piece of the inventory. In talking to Rusty, what I came to, first of all, I realized that I never said the prayer asking to set aside what I thought about nuns, because I didn't want to look at it from an entirely different angle. Now, I'd have told you that I had, but I realized in hindsight that I'd never done that. You see, sometimes I have to ask myself, do I really want to know the truth? Because sometimes I don't. Sometimes there's a payoff to the way I'm feeling and to the way I'm thinking, and it allows me to behave or not behave in certain ways. So I had to go back after talking to Rusty and look at this. And what I realized is that I set the nuns up to be God. I set them up to be the voice of God. And when this nun said to me what she said, what I imagined, I'll correct that, what I imagined she said to me, whether she said it or not, I thought, this is God speaking. What I realized is that, you know, at the age of 34, at this point I was probably like 35, looking back on the inventory, I realized that, remember what we talked about earlier this morning when we talked about insanity, lack of proportion, and the inability to think straight? Every time I thought about this, I didn't think about it as a 36-year-old woman. I was back to being a 7-year-old child, thinking about this stuff. Now, if I'm 36 years old and looking back and thinking about it as a 7-year-old child, there's a lack of proportion in my thinking, and I'm not thinking straight. So when I thought about it in that manner as a child at the age of 36, I see not a woman, not a young woman who's inexperienced in the world, who's secluded, but like I said, the voice of God. So as I look at it from the right angle, setting aside what she did, asking God to help me, I saw just a scared, frightened young woman who, in the early 60s, people didn't talk about sex. People didn't talk about sexual abuse. It just wasn't done. And I had no clue what kind of training this young woman had or what kind of life she led. I don't know if perhaps she was running from a family where who knows what was going on in the family. What she knew or anything. She probably got done that day with our little catechism class and headed out to the door and went to the nearest nun she saw and said, oh my God, I don't know what to do. This kid said blah, 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 blah. What do you think that means? Or she might have locked it in the recesses of her mind. Who knows? But the point is that she wasn't God, and that's how I was seeing her. So just to fast forward, I did make amends after talking to Rusty, going back to Rusty and talking about this. And Rusty said to me, she says, well, you need to make that right. I said, I know. That's why I'm here talking to you. And she asked me, do you know any nuns? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And she said, who? I said, well, I have an aunt who's a nun. And she says, great. That's terrific. She says, I want you to go and be as kind and loving to her, you know, just treat her right. And so I did. She actually came to my mother's house to visit my mother about 2 weeks after this happened, and we invited her to dinner, and I made dinner for her. And, you know, we get along very, very well today. But, you know, the point is that I have to find where I'm at fault in the resentment. What does it say? The inventory was ours and not the other man's. So, well, I'll let you share.
Thanks. She's going to let me hammer that piece a little bit. one of my all-time favorites. Okay. You know, I've done an awful lot with the fourth step over the years, both before. I did way too much before I got to the big book. I did every guide imaginable, and, you know, you don't even want to hear about it. But it wasn't what Alcoholics Anonymous says to do, you know, and there were no guarantees attached to it. Since I've been hooked up with big book people, I've seen an awful lot of stuff, too. I mean, a lot of extrapolation, you know, where you just take what's written in the book and then you add to it and add to it. And I think there's some good stuff that you can add to it. One of the problems that I see, I don't think the original guys, when they were writing inventory, were writing these long pieces where they got into deep analysis about this and that and what does that mean and what's underneath that. And I think they just wrote it out, you know, and they just hammered it out and they just talked to each other about it, took it to God, and went on their merry way. And, you know, there's pros and cons with that. I mean, you can sweep things under the rug that climb out of the rug later and get you, you know. But what I see oftentimes places that we go is people trying to really use the fourth step as a tool to fix themselves. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, rather than just keeping it simple and not getting into a bunch of analysis, they're trying to use the fourth step, make it more complicated, get into some deep analysis, you know, get some kind of self-understanding, you know, some self-knowledge that they're, you know, through which they can fix themselves. And as I understand it, that's God's job. That's not my job to do that. So I've gone way out into left field, and lately I've come back, and my inventories are very brief and to the point anymore.
Here's one of my inventories that I did a while ago. There's two resentments on here, and then there's this page here on the other side, and there's two resentments on here. Very simple. It's very quick.
And if you've never written inventory, you're not going to fit. If you fit your, you come to me with an inventory on a napkin like that, I'll send you home in a heartbeat. You know, forget it. But it's this deep analysis stuff that starts to bother me about it. Let me read a few things. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Destroys more. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. Okay, I never read the word disease in the big book other than right here on page 64. I mean, at least not in the 164 pages. It may be there, but I never noticed it. For we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Okay? You ever know people who get sober and right away they're in the gym and they're jogging and they're, you know... No, you've never known anyone like that, right? Our friend Mickey M. says, the problem with that is you can't outrun alcoholism. You know, you can jog all day, but you're not going to get away from it. And don't look back, because something might be gaining on you. And it is. You know? In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We list people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry, and Juanita went through all the various... aspects of self that were hurt, threatened, or interfered with. So we look at all that stuff, and I could go into some deep analysis with the third column and all that, but I'm not going to. I'll let somebody else do that with you. Let's see. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully, and the first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Okay? But to conclude that others was wrong was as far as most of us ever got. I blamed the whole world for everything in my life. I don't know if you did. Okay. Usual outcome, people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse. Then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It's plain that any life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Why is that plain? That's what I always ask. I ask my guys, is that plain to you? Well, it's plain to me because I blamed people and hated them, but they didn't change at all. It didn't do anything to most of them, you know, unless I got in a drunken fist fight with them, in which case they normally beat me up. But here's a little equation they throw at us. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? I got sober. I was 38 years old. My children were mostly grown. They were half grown. I'd missed their growing up. I'd missed a whole marriage that I was in. I'd missed half my life, basically. And so when I read that to have resentment is to squander the hours that might have been worthwhile, it just sent a chill down my neck, okay? Because I'd squandered so much of my life, I didn't want to squander any more of it, okay? I think we looked up squander, it said spend worthlessly or spend uselessly, something like that. But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. I use grave. I think of it's going to put me in the grave. We found that it is fatal. It means it'll kill me. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with me, Tom, to drink is to die. It's a total no-brainer. It's just an easy equation. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. Okay. Now, in the beginning, when I read that, I thought, well, if I ever get angry, I'm not a good AA. You know, did you ever think that? Oh, I was angry. Oh, the shame of it, you know. Well, I get angry every day, okay? So maybe I'm not a good AA. I don't know. But I'm not driven by anger, okay? It doesn't hang on me the way it did, okay? We talked last night, some of us were talking about what is resentment, and I told about a Navajo kid in the penitentiary who I was explaining what a resentment was from my point of view. And he said, oh, a replay. I know that one, a replay. I said, exactly, there you go. You know, I can't shake it. It's with me. It's crippling me all the time.
Refeel it over and over again. Right. Every time I think about it, I'm feeling the feelings one more time.
The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. Of course, we looked up brainstorm because today that's a good idea, right? But brainstorm in 39 was, it said, mental unrest, a storm in the brain. That's not for me. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, perhaps.
Dubious.
Yeah, it's doubtful, but maybe normal people can afford that. But for the alcoholic, these things are poison. I don't want more poison. We turned back to the list where it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Juanita told you it's 180 degrees. It's the opposite angle. It's if I thought this was true, now I think this is false. And you told me that that was true, and I said it was a lie, and now I see it's true. Okay, it's the
third step says that we're going to go through the triumphant arc to freedom. The next sentence here says that we look back at the list, it holds the key to the future. So if I'm going to go through this triumphant arc in which I'm going to pass through freedom, here's my key. My key is that I've got my resentment list, and I'm not going to keep looking at it from the standpoint of you're to blame for my life. You're to blame for my misery. He's to blame for my life. He's to blame for my misery. It's like, I'm going to go back and look at myself. What was going on with me? What did I do? What did I not do? This is my stuff, not his.
We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. Now it says it's going to kill me. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than we could alcohol. I don't want to feel this way, but I can't shake it. It clings to me. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Okay? Now, somehow or another, we skipped over the part that said we invariably find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Okay. So our troubles are basically of our own making, right? I don't know where that is, but third step. We normally read that. What Mary Thayer had said to me was, Tom, you're the fish you've got to catch. Okay. And I said, yeah, but Juanita, she said, shh, you're the fish you've got to catch. What were you up to? Okay. Now, getting into some prayer stuff, I think these are important because they've worked for me. I'm sharing my experience with you. When I've said these prayers, something has changed. Something has shifted. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. So I turn that into a prayer because it says we ask God. I say, God, please help me to show Joe Blow the same pity, tolerance, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Okay? When a person offended, we said to ourselves, Joe Blow is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Okay, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. I was reading some inventory to Don one time, and I couldn't get where I was going with it. I mean, I couldn't get free of it, is what I'm saying. And he said, did you say a prayer and ask that God show you how to take a kindly and tolerant view of that person? I said, I didn't know that that was a prayer. He said, sure. He said, read the big book. Okay, I still don't read that as a prayer, but Don told me that it was one. Okay, I don't know if those of you who know his story, that he was in the penitentiary in Colorado, and the guys were telling him about this stuff, so he was going to try it out. He thought it was a bunch of hokum, right? And so he said, okay, God, show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view of Adolf Hitler. And he slept on it, and in the morning when he woke up, what was on his mind was the Volkswagen. And that Hitler had had some part in the Volkswagen in bringing transportation. And it's not that that let Hitler off the hook, but he had to start laughing that there was a power there that would do that, that would flip this thing, okay? So, I mean, that's a far-out example. But when I started doing this and saying this third prayer, it made a huge difference. And what Don told me, we said, Tom, that's a substitute thought. That's when that little niggling kind of a resentment starts up again. You substitute this good thing that God has given you for that. It sounds a little Pollyanna, but if your life depends on it, why would you not want to be Pollyanna? As far as that goes, you know what I'm saying?
When I put this thought, God, show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view of my uncle who molested me, what came to me was he must have been hurt in the same way when he was a child. Okay, that's the first thought that came to me. And another thought that came to me was, how miserable must this poor man be today? Because he was. He was a drunk. He was an alcoholic to the very, very end. Now, I will tell you that my view of my uncle changed to such a degree that when he passed away last December, I called Tom up on the phone, and I told him that my uncle had passed away, and I was crying. I was crying, and I was sad that I had lost a family member. So I came around full circle. I think with these prayers, for me, it's a measure, it's a yardstick of how willing I am to work this program. How willing am I to be free? If I'm willing to say these prayers, that says a lot. If I'm not willing to say these prayers, you know, there's a part of me that chooses to die. Every day I get to make a decision. Am I going to live or am I going to die? And to be able to say this prayer means I'm going to live. I'm going to live for today.
There's one other thing that Don told me when he explained this as a prayer. God, please show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view of this person. What he said to me, he said, Tom, this is the forgiveness piece. I never heard him say that. I never heard him say it in a talk, one-on-one. He never said that to me except for that one time. And he said, this is the forgiveness piece. And he said, forgiveness is to make it as if it never happened at all. And something clutched up in my guts when he said that. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't like the sound of that. And what I got was, I'll forgive you, but I'll never forget because I might need it. I keep it in my hip pocket, and if you screw up again, I'm going to whip it out and remind you of how you screwed up, right? Okay, I need this. You know, I can't let this go because you may cross the line again, and I need to pull it out and show it to you, okay? He said, no, that's not what we do. We take it out of our pocket. We throw it away. We let God be our first line of defense if we need defending. Okay? But I'm defending myself, I think, with this resentment that I'm going to pocket, but I'm never going to let go of it. I'm not going to throw it in the trash. This is not subtle stuff. Some people think it is, but it really isn't. Okay? If I'm holding on to it and it's Juanita said it, and it'll kill me. What am I up to? What am I doing? I'm suicidal. Okay? Now, here's the part that everybody hates me for that I'm going to get into now. You ever hear people in AA say, or you may have said it yourself within the last week, and then I was willing to look at my part in it. I did my inventory, and I saw my part. You ever heard that? No, no one's ever heard that. No, they don't say that in New York, right? Only in Santa Fe do they say, I was looking at my part, right? Okay. Just wanted to clear that one up. Good. You guys don't need fixing then. Okay, here's what it says. Here's the philosophy of this deal. Referring to our list again and putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes.
You mean forgetting their part?
Okay. It doesn't say part. It says mistake. Okay, number one thing, where was I mistaken? Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. You think they meant entirely, completely? Do you think? Yeah, I do too. I think they really meant that. Where were we to blame? Okay, I was mistaken. Now they're talking about where was I to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. I've already had my fun with the other man in the second column. Okay, as much fun as I'll ever have with it, I've had in the second column. That's over with. That part's done. Okay, the inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, so it says, where was I at fault? Where was I mistaken? Where was I to blame? We listed them. I list my faults. Okay, we placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly. So I was wrong, mistaken, at fault, and to blame. That's what it says. That's what the big book says. I'm sorry, but that's what it says.
And we become willing to set these matters straight. It begins talking about the eighth and ninth step right here in the fourth step.
Absolutely. This is what I've seen, and Don, you know, drilled this into me I don't know how many times for at least the last 12 years. People love to say, I was willing to look at my part, okay? It's subtle stuff, but when you talk about part of something, you're always referring back to the whole. I want my part of the apple pie. What do you think of? The apple pie, right? No, I'm only talking about my little part, okay? You always have a bigger part. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? It's so, not what was my part. We put out of our mind entirely what the other person did. We look at where we were mistaken, where we were at fault. I just stick to where was I at fault. That's easier for me, okay? But the deal is so many people need for the other person to still be wrong or to blame in order for them to accept fault and blame themselves. And then the whole thing falls apart. It doesn't work.
Especially when they go to make amends.
Yeah, Don used to say, you know, that if you do this thing with what was my part, well, you know, they were a-holes, but, you know, I looked at my part out of the, you know, graciousness of my soul. When you go to make amends to these people and you make your amends and then they don't make amends back for their part, then you're pissed off again, all over again. The resentment comes back. Often it does, not every time, but often it does. So it's, I don't think you can overemphasize this.
I've had quite a few gals I sponsor come back to me after they made amends, and they said, I made my amends to them, and they'd never said a word, you know? It's like they never said how they were sorry. And I said, well, why should they? I said, we don't care what they did. We don't care what they did at all. This is your stuff. You're the one who has to clean up your side of the street, not them.
I'm the fish I've got to catch. What was I up to? Okay. I got to put out of my mind entirely what they did for this thing to work. That's the dynamic of it. Resolutely look for my own mistakes, not what was my part. You can quote me on that.
So briefly, I'm going to share with you another quick little inventory. And this was just one little thing that happened. This was probably 10 years ago. And we were building our home. And my sponsor, Mary Thayer, was at our house because we'd been up to the conference and she came home with us. And long story short, our daughter came home one night, and she found our dog on the front steps, and our dog had been shot. We had to take our dog in and have our dog put to sleep. And we believed firmly that it was my aunt who shot the dog. And the reason we think it was my aunt who shot the dog, who lives next door to us, was that my cousin, her daughter, and her son-in-law had come to our house several times and said, our mom is really upset with your dog because your dog is bothering the chickens. We live out in the country. And, you know, she's getting to the chickens. And, you know, we live in the country, so they don't like dogs that eat chickens in the country. They're shot quite often. Well, we had quite an uproar, didn't we? Mm-hmm. Quite an uproar. He's furious. Our daughter is destroyed. He's distraught. I mean, everybody is a mess. And it goes on for a while. It gets ugly. We call the sheriff, and it goes on, and he nearly has fist fights, and it's not pretty.
You sure you remember that right?
This is so funny. I'm following up the road one day behind him, and my cousin, who's the son-in-law of my aunt, is coming down, and he stops his car, because the son-in-law, my cousin, is walking down the road, and he gets out of the car, and they're shaking their fists at each other, and I jump out of the car behind him, and I'm going, Tom, get back in that car. What are you doing? And he starts to get back in the car, and then all of a sudden he goes, you can just hear the wheels clicking in his head, like, why do I have to listen to that? And he, like, gets back out in the road and starts shaking his fist at it. Anyway, you get the picture. Well, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand this. I couldn't stand the way I was feeling. So I sat down, called my sponsor, and started to write some steps. You know, took it through from the first step, finally through the fourth step. And when I sat down and wrote my resentments on the fourth step as to why I was angry, and I put down my aunt, my cousin, you know, her husband, you know, blah, 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 blah. When I got to the fourth column, putting aside completely what had been done, my dog being shot, their actions, and I looked where I was at fault, what I realized was I knew that there was a problem. I knew it. Now, see, my thought was she ought to be a grown-up. I'm in the program. I know that, you know, if there's a problem, they ought to come talk to me. So she should be a grown-up and come talk to me and not send my cousin or her husband to my house in a, you know, triangulated way to tell me that there's something going on. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut and let her come talk to me. Well, knowing there's a problem, and I'm the one who has a program, allegedly, I should go and knock on her door and say, Tia, aunt, what's going on? I hear there's a problem. I hear my dog is after your chickens. Can you tell me more about this? And I didn't. And Tom at one point asked me, should I go talk to your aunt about this? And I said, nah, because I'm scared. I'm scared about, you know, there being some kind of fight, because I was scared of my aunt, quite frankly. You know, and I was scared that something would happen, you know, and then, you know, who wants to live in that environment? Well, we ended up living in that environment. So I was the one who was to blame. I was to blame. I was the one who set the ball rolling. I knew that there was a problem, and I didn't stand up. I was not responsible. One of the second times I ever did a workshop at my home, I had this one gal. And we got to the fourth step, and at one point she turned to me as we began talking about the resentment inventory, and she says, you know, I am so angry at you. And I said, really? Why? And she said, you lied to me. And I said, well, if I did, I didn't mean to. You want to tell me, you know, tell me what's going on here? And I, you know, it's a little weird. I'm doing the workshop, and she's sitting there with all these other women, and she's accusing me of lying to her. And I said, so tell me, Peggy, why do you think I'm lying to you? And she says, well, she said, you didn't tell me that if I did this work, that if I did these steps, that I was going to have to be responsible. That's the problem with the step work. You see, I have wanted to hide. I have not wanted to be responsible my whole entire life. I've always wanted somebody else to be responsible, and I get to just skate behind them. And this program, if I'm really working it, doesn't let me do that. I have to stand up and be a grown-up. and not be a kid. I was the one who was at fault. I was the one who allegedly had the program. I needed to go to them and speak and say, what's going on? Can we solve this? Instead, I don't want to be responsible.
Thanks. Okay. It says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Ms. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it, meaning that it's all through me. It's a part of me. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. Did you ever get fearful and do something that later boomeranged back at you, you know, exploded in your face? I've done that all my life, you know. 98% of the lies I ever told was because I was just scared to death to tell the truth, and that's why I lied. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Okay, sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to have caused more trouble. I worked with that for a long time to be able to understand that. And what they did was they answered it later. Let's see. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. Asked ourselves why we had them. Why would I set the ball rolling, or how did I set the ball rolling? And it says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, didn't go far enough. Remember I told you that it took about 5.5 years of experimentation with running my life on self-will sober to realize that I couldn't run my life on self-will sober? I've been talking about it all weekend, right? Unmanageability, second half, first step. Okay, but I continued to do it way after it wasn't working, and I was aware of that. So I go into a situation. I'm using self-will to get as my gasoline to get the job done. I have a long history of it not working, and I'm scared to death. Okay? It ain't paranoia. You know, it's righteous fear. I should have those fears because I know that self-will hasn't worked for me in the past. Yet I'm trying it one more time, and I'm scared to death because I've got this long history of failure. Does that make sense? Okay. I got that finally. It took a long time to put that one together. I'm a real slow teach, I'll tell you. Some of us once had great self-confidence. I don't think I ever did. I would play like it to try to fool you, but I never really was confident. But it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role he assigns. This next sentence is one of our immediate AA family's all-time favorites. Mary Thayer ends every talk she ever gives with this line, and it's a great, great promise. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? It's a great one, huh?
It comes in equal measure.
Yeah. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. Verdict of the ages is that faith means courage, and all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to, and here's the fear prayer. I added it to my morning prayers. I've been saying it for years. I thought I was the only one, and some chick at York Street said the same thing. And I went, oh, I thought I was finally unique. But we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. Not do, what would he have us be. And here's a promise connected with that. At once we commenced to outgrow fear. That's a neat deal. I want that. Okay. You know, I think my first inventories were just every fear I could think of, and I was afraid of just about everything. Lately, what I've been zeroing in on is the fears that keep me from realizing my heart's desire, keep me from realizing my dreams. Okay? I'm a musician without an instrument, essentially. I mean, I have extreme musical talent, but I'm so damn lazy I never learned how to play anything. And I have a deep desire to learn how to play the guitar. I can play air guitar. I can, you know.
Quite well, too, huh?
Yeah. But I'm afraid. I'm afraid to put in the effort. I mean, I could analyze it and go into all the reasons, but basically it's a fear that's crippling a dream of mine. I've got a half-written novel, but it's half-written in my head, okay? I want to write it. I know what it's about. I could tell you the storyline. The whole. It's really cool stuff. It's really great stuff. But I have this fear that it'll be a failure or that people will laugh at it or whatever my fear is, and it keeps the novel from being written. And I'm examining that. You know, how big is my God? Is it big enough to write a novel that flops? You know, is it big enough to learn how to play the guitar and not play it very well? You see what I'm saying? Would God be there, catch me? Would I be okay if I did that? Okay? The fears that cripple me from realizing my dreams, that's what I'm looking at today. That's all I've got on fear. Anything else?
I was given some real specific questions my last time through the fear inventory. And I'm gonna just give them to you, just to give them to you.
If I just can for find something them. To do.
Yeah, just because. And I'm probably not going to find them, so I'm going to see if I think I can remember them. So, what's the fear? Actually, I'll take you through it, and then I think we'll pause for a break, okay? So, one of my last inventories that I can remember, the inventory that I did regarding jealousy. I had on there fear of being alone. And, okay, that's the fear. Then I was asked to write down, when do I first remember having this fear? Well, the first time I ever remember having this fear was when my aunt passed away and I was about 8 years old, 8 or 9 years old. And my aunt was the one who raised me. My mother worked full-time, as did my father. And my aunt, my great aunt, raised me. And I remember the morning when the phone rang, and it was my mother who had been at the hospital calling my father saying that my aunt was dead. And I just felt this sense, this deep sense of overwhelming sadness and just, oh my God, now who's here to protect me? Because I grew up in a family where my father drank and my mother, you know, was an unrecovered family member, and there was not much going on at home in terms of communication and safety. I mean, real safety. That's why I ended up in a position where I could be sexually molested, because we're in with alcoholism, we don't protect our children. We were a family living together, going our separate ways. Each one of us, speaking from my experience, I was alone. There were four of us in that home, my mom, my dad, my younger brother, and myself. I might as well have been the only person in that house. So that's when I first remember having this fear. And then the next question was, what do I do to try and manage the fear? What do I do to try and manage the fear? Which is my self-reliance that the book speaks to. You know, my self-reliance. What do I do to try and manage the fear? And I came up with all sorts of stuff, long list. I just, at the top of my head, can't remember it exactly. So I wrote down on that. Now, that's all nice, but that's really a nice little exercise, intellectual awareness. You know, and my sponsor likes to say, you're in the middle of a spiritual experience, and what you have now is an intellectual understanding, but you've not yet had a spiritual awakening. So that's all nice. But the next question was, if you could look behind the door, if fear was a door, and you could look beyond the fear, what would your life look like? In other words, it's like what Tom's talking about. What's the dream? What's my heart's desire? If I could look beyond the fear, and the fear is keeping me from truly living my heart's desire, living out my dream, what's going on? Well, what I saw, I think I remember this correctly, as I looked behind this fear of being alone, I always was afraid to let my light shine. I always hung my star on somebody else. My sponsor once said to me, she said, you have more, I can't remember what it was, in your little finger than, you know, so-and-so has in their whole being. She said, but why do you always hide your light? Why do you hide your light? I'm more afraid of being in the light than being in the dark. I am more afraid of realizing my full potential and letting you see me for who I truly am and be in the world as God would have me be. I would rather hide in my little cave and let the world go by out of my fear than to be fully present. So I saw that. I saw that. That's what I was truly afraid of. You see, I thought the fear was the fear of being alone. Mm-mm. The real fear was having you see me. Really having you see me. Because if you really see me, what if you don't like what you see?
Is that it?
Yep.
Okay, now about sex. Oh, should we? You want to?
Yeah, we better. It's
okay, no time for sex. Let's take a break. But let's get back. What time do you want to come back? Because we don't have much time left.
15 minutes, 4:45. Okay.
4:45. Okay.